Welcome this morning. Today we're going to just take a look at the final part of the teachings that the Lord delivered to Nicodemus. So this is the fourth part in that series. And today we're going to examine this idea of the states through which a person passes in their regeneration. And these states were described a few weeks back from a reading from the Divine Providence as a state of condemnation, state of reformation, and a state of regeneration. And today we're going to focus on this idea of the state of condemnation. What is it and why is it that prior to being born again, our life is such that it exists in a state of condemnation? This is a central question that needs to be answered, because without seeing it, there won't be any motivation to undergo the rebirth. There won't be seen a need for a rebirth to happen. And so we have to come to see exactly what it is that is or stands condemned, and why it is condemned. And what we shall see is that it has nothing to do with the Lord condemning anybody. It has to do with the state of life, or the state of the mind, because it's the state of mind that is either receptive of what the Lord is in terms of his goods and truths, or it rejects those things. And so we have to come to see that a state of condemnation exists where the Lord is shut out. But a state of salvation or reformation and regeneration exists where goods and truths from the Lord's word are allowed in to restructure the human mind.
So our reading from the Gospel of John this morning is chapter 3, verses 17 to 21. For God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but that the world through him might be saved. He who believes in him is not condemned, but he who does not believe is condemned already, because he has not believed in the name of the only begotten Son of God. And this is the condemnation, that the light has come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. For everyone practicing evil hates the light and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who does the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be clearly seen that they have been done in God.
And the reading from the teachings for the church this morning is from the work The Arcana Celestia, and it's number 2335. As regards judgment, it is twofold, namely, from good and from truth. The faithful are judged from good, but the unfaithful from truth. That the faithful are judged from good is plainly evident in Matthew 25:34-40, and that the unfaithful are judged from truth, Matthew 25:41-46. To be judged from good is to be saved because they have received it. But to be judged from truth is to be condemned because they have rejected good. Good is the Lord's, and they who acknowledge this in life and faith are the Lord's, and therefore are saved. But they who do not acknowledge it in life, and consequently not in faith, cannot be the Lord's, and therefore cannot be saved. They are therefore judged according to the acts of their life, and according to their thoughts and purposes. And when they are judged according to these, they cannot but be condemned, for it is a truth that of himself a man does, thinks, and intends nothing but evil, and of himself rushes to hell in so far as he is not withheld from it by the Lord. But as regards judgment from truth, the case is this. The Lord never judges anyone except from good, for he desires to raise all into heaven, however many they may be, and indeed, if it were possible, even to himself. For the Lord is mercy itself and good itself. Mercy itself and good itself can never condemn anyone. But it is the man who condemns himself because he rejects good. As in the life of the body he had shunned good, so does he shun it in the other life. Consequently, he shuns heaven and the Lord, for the Lord cannot be in anything except good. He is likewise in truth, but not in truth separated from good. That the Lord condemns no one, nor judges any to hell, he says in John, God sent not his Son into the world to judge the world, but that the world through him might be saved. This is the judgment, that the light has come into the world, but men love darkness rather than light, because their works were evil. And in the same, if anyone hear my words and believe not, I judge him not, for I came not to judge the world, but to save the world. We have these three states which a person passes through, three general broad states that a person passes through on the course of their regeneration or being reborn, and they are this beginning state, which is a state of condemnation, and then there is a state of reformation, and then there is a state of regeneration. The state of condemnation has to do with a state of life in which good is rejected, and a state of life in which self is at the centre. State of reformation has to do with the acquisition of truths and a reforming of our beliefs, a restructuring of the principles from which we live. This is a state of reformation, and it has to do with the reforming of the mind. Now, the state of regeneration is that state when that process of reformation has occurred, and what then begins to happen is that we move into a state where, as at one point it was a life of obedience in terms of having to put down what was obstructing the Lord's life in us, and of our own will doing what we believed to be right, even when it didn't feel good to do that. But a state of regeneration has to do with when there is a new will, new delights start to come, in which there is a delight in doing the things of the Word. And so this is the broad spectrum of the course of spiritual life. And so it involves struggles and temptations and all that sort of thing. But it leads to having a new will, new delights, grounded in what is heavenly. And so this whole process is one of the Lord removing us from states of selfishness and implanting within us those things that can bring about states of loving the Lord and loving our neighbour. So we've covered over these last few weeks a number of key concepts, and I think just to summarise a few of those, the idea of what your spirit is. This is a critical idea. It's such an important truth because when it's clearly grasped, it shows us where our spiritual work lies, where we will find it and what it involves. Now, your spirit is you. Your spirit is you. It is who you are. Now, questions like, who am I? What is a human being? What makes us who we are? These are some of the most profound questions a person can ask. And every genuine spiritual path seeks to provide answers for questions such as these. And the teachings for spiritual Christianity are no different. Our teachings offer us truths that seek to guide us towards finding the answers to such questions as these. And we learn that our spirit is our mind. And that the quality of our self is revealed in the thoughts and the affections that we identify with on a daily basis. The ones that we delight in and so keep alive in ourselves and make our own. This is what reveals the state of our self. We have an ability to gather and bring together a system of thoughts and affections and identify with these and call them ourself, who we are. So the very fact that we can gather these things together speaks of something deeper. The self that actually does the gathering, the observing of these thoughts and affections. This deeper part is found in the fact that we can actually separate ourselves from the thoughts and affections that pass through our minds and we can look at them. So there is something doing the looking. And this is the deeper part of ourself. So we are just not the thoughts and affections. We are something that lies behind those and gathers them and identifies with those that suit us. The ones that we choose to invite into the home of our minds and entertain. These reflect something deeper. And we're going to have a little look at that in a moment. But the fact that our ability to reflect on our thoughts and our affections exists shows that we can think of the self or our spirit or our mind in terms of levels. The thoughts and the affections at a more external level. And the one that does the gathering and the identifying with us, with those at a slightly deeper level. So who is this us at a deeper level that does this selecting and this gathering? See, we can be conscious of our thoughts and affections, but we are much less conscious of what underlies and organizes these into a sense of ourselves that we are aware of as ourselves. What underlies the myriad of feelings and thoughts that pass through our minds or spirits every day is a belief structure and values that govern how we see and relate to the world with its situations and circumstances, other people, life, and God. And beliefs and values tend to be a much more stable level of being than the thoughts and feelings we experience. And so they act like a filter through which these more external spiritual influences are organized. Now it is these underlying beliefs and values that determine what we are sensitive to, how we are affected by the conditions we experience in external life, how we interpret and give meaning to what happens to us in our life. And while there is no denying that we experience an external world, there is also no denying that each person's experience of that world is unique to them. We cannot experience another person's experience of the world. It is unique to them. And this is because no two people have identical belief systems. Our experience of life is unique to each of us. So in this sense, each of us lives in a very different world to every other person around us, at least as far as our inner world goes. Now the point here is that our individual inner personal worlds are constructed and created through the beliefs we hold to. And this is a very important spiritual truth. And it's a truth that can be very liberating and full of hope. Because it means that if our sense of self is dependent on the beliefs we hold to, then it can be changed. We all have experienced changes in our beliefs. And so this creates a possibility for change. It means that if we take to ourselves new beliefs found in the truths that a genuine religion teaches and live from these, then we can undergo a transformation and be reborn as to our spirits. But we can go a little deeper than the thoughts and affections and the beliefs. And if we go a little deeper, we can ask ourselves the question, what holds our beliefs together? What holds them into this system that we carry with us? Now, the teachings for spiritual Christianity offer us an answer to this question as well. Our belief systems are built around what we love most. So right at the core, it comes down to what we love. What we love builds the beliefs, which then selects the thoughts and affections and gives us a sense of what the world and the effects that are occurring around us are all about. They're all filtered through that. But it all comes back to supporting this love that lies at the core. And while there are an infinite variety of loves, as many as there are individuals that have lived, that will live, it's infinite, the number of loves that exist, they can, however, be traced back in general terms to either one of two pairs of loves. In simple terms, there are two pairs of loves, one of which every human being becomes a unique expression of through the choices they make over the course of their lives. Now, the first pair of loves, and it is these into which every person entering into the world is born, are natural loves, being the love of self and the love of the world. The second pair of loves is that into which a person is born by virtue of undergoing a spiritual rebirth, being love to the Lord and love towards our neighbour. These are the two pairs of loves. Now, I think we can all see that if love to the Lord and our neighbour sits at the centre of our sense of self, then our minds will be organized in terms of its beliefs and values, etc., very differently to a mind whose beliefs are organized around the loves of self and the world. The two mental worlds, that is the mind created by these two pairs of loves, will be very different in their structure and quality. One is open to heavenly things, and one is closed. So because this is the case, the way in which the external world with its situations and circumstances, our interactions with others, the meaning we bring to all the aspects of life we're affected by, what we are sensitive to, and how we interpret it all, will be literally worlds apart depending on which of these loves rule in our life. Now, one of the most important principles of spiritual life is this idea that how we take the outer world of our experience is a direct reflection of how our inner world is organized with its systems of beliefs, values, and love. We come back to this question: what makes a human being a human being? Again, the teachings for spiritual Christianity, they point us to an answer. They teach that there are two things that set human beings apart from animals. The two pillars upon which the human mind is founded are the freedom which belongs to the will faculty and the rationality which belongs to the understanding faculty. The way in which these two faculties are structured are such as that a person can go from being natural to becoming spiritual through a consciousness of a self being free to acquire one's own life through choosing what values one is going to live from. Animals don't have that ability. This means that we are given the ability to have the core loves around which our mind is organized changed. We can get new loves. We can acquire new beliefs. This is not the case with animals, as they are purely natural and function from within a very limited range of behaviors fixed or bound to the instincts into which they are born. Relative to human beings, animals are born pretty much with all they need to live their life, and so reach maturity and are able to fully function in the life of their species in a comparatively quick degree of time. No point occurs in an animal's life where it has an opportunity to make a conscious decision to live its life in a particular way, according to a particular set of values or beliefs. This capacity is a uniquely human one, and it is something every person has from the Lord, whether he is acknowledged or not. Generally speaking, human life, or what is the same, the life of the human mind, involves gathering information, formulating and organizing it, and using it in a way to fulfill its desires. General terms. It is this capacity to grow and to develop on the mental plane and then build a life or world in accordance with the things there that are valued that is central to being human. Human self-consciousness only exists where there is a sense of having choice. Yes, choice within finite limitations that we all live under, but nevertheless, choice. Freedom to act within those limitations. Freedom in a spiritual and psychological sense, or in a truly human sense, is the ability to see and assess courses of action in the light of our values and conscience, and then choose one over others. Along with this comes the ability to take responsibility for our actions, knowing that for each choice made, there are a number of possibilities that remain unfulfilled in those courses of action not taken. But we are responsible. We make the choice. The ability to act in freedom requires the ability to be conscious that we are the agent who is acting, and that our actions are the result of a free choice for which we are responsible in view of the values and principles we hold to. You see, if our actions are purely the result of instinctual drives, with the most powerful drive finding expression, then we are not in a state of freedom or choice. We can't be regarded as free, nor can we be really regarded as something human. The kind of freedom that provides us with a sense of being an independent, autonomous self demands that we have the ability to reflect on our motives, and so know that we exist as an independent, conscious being who is responsible for our actions. Why is this so important? It's important because it provides us with the ability to actually reject acting on an impulse or strong instinct. In fact, it gives us the ability to consciously refuse to act on certain desires from a matter of principle. We don't have to follow our impulses. Human beings have the ability to reflect and assess their desires against truth and make a judgment as to whether it is a thing to be brought into action or not. It is in this ability to weigh the content of our mental life and assess its quality in the light of our values that the human sense of self truly lies. And it is this very ability that makes it possible for human beings to be regenerated and so become spiritual. So coming back to this teaching referred to earlier, that all people who are born into this world are born natural. That is, they are born into natural loves, but have the potential to become spiritual. Human beings are born incomplete. They are born with an incredible potential. But it's over to them whether that potential will be fulfilled or not. Now, because we are born into natural loves, which are the love of self and the love of the world, over the course of our natural mental development, our sense of self becomes wedded to beliefs that support these natural loves. Now, there is no way of minimizing the nature of these loves when separated from the governance of higher loves from the Lord. The Word and the heavenly doctrines are emphatic on this. These loves, in and of themselves, are hell-bent. They're hell-bent. For they look to place the self at the center of life in place of God. Now, whether they are successful in this or not depends on how a person responds to the truths they meet over the course of their adult lives. And barring any serious debilitation in a person's mental function, every person enters adult life with a capacity to reflect on their life in the light of truths and to act to amend things in accordance with the insights they receive. If this wasn't the case, then there would be no hope of having our sense of self lifted out of its identification with natural loves, those things of the natural man, into a new, higher, spiritual love, associations with heavenly loves, where it can be identified, that is, our sense of self can be identified, reborn, re-established in a new heavenly proprium. Self, one given by the Lord. So in other words, without this ability to reflect and to weigh and to act in accordance with our understanding of truth, there would be no hope of salvation because there would be no possibility for change. The loves of self and the world into which every person is born are so opposed to heavenly loves that nothing could be more opposite. Nothing could be more opposite. These loves, for the better part of our lives, they work tirelessly to conceal the spiritual fact from us. And we have real difficulty seeing it. In fact, without divine revelation in the form of the Word and the heavenly doctrines, we would remain totally oblivious to their opposition to all that is good and true. This old self, what the writings term the proprium, is in a state of condemnation and it rules in us until we are born again, until we undergo this new birth. Now, it is built on a foundation of fear and defensiveness, because this is all the love of self and the world can produce in us. Over the course of our lives, the dominant presence of these loves builds around themselves a fortress of belief systems that the Lord, so that the Lord and others are shut out, and they're only let in on our terms. Now, of course, these systems of belief are often presented to us under the guise of a whole army of rationalizations, justifications and illusions that make out that this old self is not so bad and perfectly acceptable. It offers us a whole wardrobe of outer garments and masks, of acceptable moral and civil behaviours, of politeness and niceness, and we can wear this in the hope that its true nature is not exposed. But at the end of the day, while this proprium is in charge, everything life presents is only ever taken and used on its own terms. Everything it takes, it constructs and fashions into a form which supports its own warped view of the world. Everything and everyone becomes an extension of the self. And those who fail to meet up to its expectations, they are dismissed as being of no real consequence. Until we undergo a rebirth as to our spirit and acquire new ways of thinking and being, our whole sense of self is organized around the loves of self and the world. To be saved is to have a new character of mind, organized around love to the Lord and love towards our neighbor. These loves are simply to love truths, to love the Lord's word, and to act from it. That's what this love is. It's a love of response, not necessarily a love of feeling. It's knowing truths because the Lord has given us a rationality by which we can understand them, and acting from them because when we act from those truths, we act from the Lord Himself. And any action that comes from the Lord is designed to lift us towards what is heavenly. It's to act from these loves, to act from truths, because they are true. For no other reason than they are true. It's the right thing to do, to act from truth. And because through acting from truth, good can be produced. The good of life. Until this begins to take place, a person's identity remains bound to a state of condemnation. Not because the Lord condemns them, He doesn't. But because they choose of their own free will to remain attached to what is of hell. And no matter how much the Lord desires to remove them from this destructive state of life, if a person won't use the faculties they've been given by the Lord to take hold of truths and to remove themselves by means of their own volition from selfish states of life, then the Lord's hands are tied. He's given us everything we need to enter into the spiritual life. He can do no more. It's all there. Because you see, the Lord doesn't lift a person out of the hell of their proprium against their will. He can't do it. He cannot violate a human being's freedom to act from themselves, as if of themselves, in regard to truth and goodness. And so in order to preserve our freedom, he has provided us with the truths of the Word and the heavenly doctrines, as well as having given us a rational faculty to receive these into our mind, and a will faculty provided in these truths so that we can act from them as a matter of life. Now, we may wish that he would intervene in a more direct or spectacular kind of way, but the fact that he doesn't shows us how important our freedom is to him in spiritual matters. Our eternal welfare depends on that freedom being preserved. Everything needed for a spiritual rebirth is provided for. But if a person wants that rebirth, then they have to reach out and take hold of the provision the Lord has given. A simple act of the will from truths of the Word, and a person enters onto the path of regeneration. For to act from truths is to act from the Lord. And all actions from the Lord or the Word have one end in view: the life of heaven. It is the proprium, the loves of self and the world, that stands condemned. And it is a spiritual fact that if our sense of self is inextricably tied to this, then we stand condemned with it. The Lord can't remove our sense of self from this if we are unwilling to work with him to have our evils identified and removed so that the sense of ourselves might be detached from them. To learn truths and to use them is what is meant by loving the Lord and loving our neighbour. Love in this sense is a response, not a feeling. To believe in the Lord is nothing more and nothing less than to act from the truths of the Word, because it is this that leads to a reforming of the mind. This work with truths is what is meant by a state of reformation. As our sense of self is extracted from old selfish ways of being, so the Lord is able then to bind us more fully and more completely to the loves of heaven, giving us a new regenerated will, a new sense of ourselves, a heavenly proprium, grounded in new higher delights which are destined to break forth within the regenerate mind. A delight to do the will of the Lord. Amen.